So, programming languages, the first part. The topic is concurrency and especially machine models, memory models for concurrent programs. And, well, first of all, the usual things about concurrency. Why do we need concurrency? Well, or at least why do we need to take special care in concurrency? Well, if you look at the figures, 1997, a Pentium processor there had about 5 million transistors. In 2006, the Itanium had 1,700 million of transistors. You can imagine that the manufacturer could have assembled a processor with a lot of with multiple cores already in 2006, and it would have been a massive parallel one, 256 Pentium cores would have been quite the parallel machine. So that is a thing that would have been possible if you just look at the numbers. However, well, in 2006, I can't remember to have a 250-core machine there. So there must be reasons why this hasn't been the case back then. So, well, what are the reasons? You might know them from other language from other lectures already. Well, first of all, if you think about the algorithms that you know, a lot of them are actually not really planned in a parallel way, and a lot of them turn out to be not inherently parallel. You cannot directly implement them with a lot of different threads, for example. And it turns out that there are quite the obstacles for that. It might be difficult or in some cases even impossible to come up with a simple parallel program for that. Then the other thing is that communication between the cores is also an aspect that is quite challenging. Already the hardware that is necessary to have all these cores communicate efficiently with each other is quite bothersome to implement, and if you have a lot of cores, it tends to be quite a lot of transistors that get wasted for implementing all the circuitry to interconnect them with each others. Especially if you want to have coherent caches, for example. But yeah, that's topics for more hardware-oriented lectures. Then there's the other effect that you get if you let your N cores run an algorithm which is parallelized in some way, and compare it to letting it run only on a single core, you won't get the full scalability. You will only very, very rarely see an actual speed up of the number of cores that you have in your system. Instead, you will see a number which is likely very much smaller than the number of cores as your speed up factor in that. And there's only a few selected algorithms where you actually come close to the actual number of cores in terms of scalability. So distributing workload is something that is not easily done and might even be not possible in all of the cases. And yeah, so concurrency has not been a big topic in times where it was not necessary to go parallel. However, speeding up the computation speed of your processor is also not an option. So in the beginning, it looked like we would be in a situation where you can double your computational speed every few months at some point. However, that is something that is not true anymore at the at the technical level that we have reached right now. However, what we still get is that, or at least what seems to be still valid for the foreseeable future, is that we can double the amount of transistors on the processors themselves. So if we can't increase the processing speed anymore, well, the only option that, well, not the only option, but one of the options that is seen there is that we can just increase the number of cores that we integrate on each of the processors. And for that to be effective in any way, well, at least in more ways than just having several processes running on a machine, the programs have to become parallel. So how's that in relation to programming languages? Well, there's several points of interface that you get for accessing concurrency from a programming language. There's the idea of spawning new concurrent units or computations here. And the other thing that you might want to look at is how to communicate between the different computations or threads in that case. And there's many ways how you can implement that. There's shared memory, which we will focus on in this lecture. There's atomic transactions on the shared memory, and there's message passing. Message passing is the thing that we have not directly in the lecture, but I intend to offer a few of the in-depth topics from the 10th February talks in, for example, message passing systems and languages that are more into that kind of communication. What my intention is to talk about, what for you in terms of learning outcomes, is that we will establish what happened before partial order actually is. We will talk about strict consistency, sequential consistency, the Messy Cache protocol, weak consistency, memory barriers, and a few other things that come after. So that is the topics for this talk, or at least we'll see how far we will come today. So communication between cores in terms of shared memory, how can I envision that? Well, consider, for example, the following two functions that are intended to be run in different computations. There's one computation where we just write data to memory, A and B, and we assume these memory locations to be visible to both of the computations and to be initially zero. So the initial state is zero of the whole thing. So first of all, thread A starts and writes 1 to A, and then afterwards 1 to B. And thread B is intended to work this way. Oh, no. That's a tradition to have one something crossed out without intention on each of the talks. So the bar function is there to actually to try to realize when data is can be found in memory location A. So what it does is it observes the location B, and as long as nobody has touched B yet, it's still intended to be zero. And in that case, it will go into a loop and just try to check it again and again and again. And at some point, the computation will leave that that loop and reach the point for the assertion over here. It's getting messy here, so let's do away with that. And we will see or check what the content of A is, and if everything went the way that we think it went, then there we should find the value 1 in A. So this should always hold in systems which we consider to be consistent or correct. So that is how we would imagine communication via shared memory. Well, at least in an ideal system. In a system that we consider strictly consistent, this would hold. If we started our two threads foo and bar on systems with separate cores, where you have kind of a fixed grid where each of the instructions fits into, and where we have memory that answers read and write requests in a sequence, we can have a look at what might actually happen in runtime, and can see one of the following may happen. There might also be other schedulings for the instructions. There's such that not exactly this these instruction sequences may happen, but also others. But anyway, these are ones that might happen. So let's have a look at them. For example, we might have a scheduling where we first of all have A written into memory. Then there's scheduler sets bar active, and we will see that there's a lot of queries for B. Well, B turns out to not be touched yet, so all of the these queries from memory return with, well, still zero. So the loop in process bar will iterate, and it might iterate a long time and several times. Well, a long time until the scheduler at some point decides that that foo is once again active, and then it might set B to 1, for example. And that's just an excerpt of what might happen on the machine. We might also have other schedulings where we have A is 1 for one for the first instruction. Then, for example, B bar might be active. It might check for B. B is not yet changed. Then the scheduler might decide that foo is once again active, so that might write 1 to the memory. So in that case, we will have a query for the value of B, and then the query for the value of A. So you see, there's several ways that this program might unfold. So there are several pathways through the program, and they actually, and even several pathways that differ from each other through each of these threads, and all of them actually differ in things that we don't that we have no clear concept of how they actually work. Scheduler is something that is quite complicated, and we can't really foresee in the program. Also, timings of the instructions themselves are also something that's out of our scope here. So we have to deal with several of these things. Yeah. So there's a lot of others, but that's just examples for that. So it's quite difficult to find unique order between all the memory accesses that are actually happening, or even impossible at all, depending on what program we get there. Each of the loop iterations and all of the conditionals that we pass open up a new branch in the problem space, and the whole thing explodes quite fast. So there's also other effects, namely processors have advanced features like caches, where our initial assumption that our instructions would be executed in lockstep, which means in these fixed grids where you can have one instruction at a time and then you switch over to the next instruction, that might be quite unrealistic. In reality, we might have an instruction that needs quite a lot of CPU cycles because it has to access something hidden deep in memory. Then we might see another instruction that looks the same but is able to fulfill its data needs by just accessing the quite quick cache. And this is something that goes beyond the simple lockstep computation. So that is something which is quite unrealistic. So having a strict view on how different processes interact is maybe not the thing that we are after, but instead there's alternatives to that. And the alternative that we go here is that we leave this idea of exact timings and time slots and all of that being fixed to state correctness in another way, in the way that that we have to deal with what may happen before or after certain events. So what we're leaving is exact time slots, exact timings, and we go over to the concept of events. And that's what we're modeling with the happened before relation in distributed systems. So in distributed systems, we get different processes, PQR, and these processes, for example, process P consists of several events, P1, P2, PI, same as process Q or process R, and they somehow relate to each other. You see an example over here. The process itself is this just straight line over here. So the process for P is represented as this kind of line over here. And the events that happen during execution of process P is event P1, P2, P3, and P4. And these are events that that are triggered by the instructions that we find in the algorithm that is executed by the thread that belongs to this process. So this line P is kind of our model for a certain sequence of instructions that came to existence by executing code. So this P1, P2, P3, P4, these are somehow related to the instructions that we find in our program. For example, when we perform a computation where we read something, then store something away, we get even several events from that. So there might be the event of querying for a data value that we need for our computation. That might be an event in there. That might be P1, for example. And at some point, we might get the answer to our query. That might be, for example, well, it might be P2. So these are events that we get, and we place them on this line that represents the relation that comes from the instructions. So yeah, p. If we have this thing that, for example, this p. Let's try to do something that's actually connected. So, for example, if we have a p5 and a p6 over here, where the p5 is the event that belongs to trying to read a value, and p6 is the event that belongs to receiving the value. This means that they need to be one after each other on this line, because p5 needs to be happening before p6. So if we find these events on the same process line, that means that they are connected to each other in terms of one has to happen before the other. Then there's, yeah, so that's what you find over here. Two events that are numbered increasingly happen before each other. The other thing is that we want to use the system in order to model communication between several partners that act concurrently, that act in parallel. So we need some way of modeling inter-process dependencies, and that's what we're going to do with sending messages on the underlying hardware. And yeah, we see that happening, for example, here from P1 to Q2, or from Q5 to P4. So these are, for example, an event where I say I intend to that might be a program, for example, a thread, and this might be yellow is not good. This might be memory, and this might be my program on the processor. And I might want to write to memory. What I do then is I read the memory write in this process, and this X is kept in memory. So I need to communicate to the memory that lives on my hardware in parallel to the processor, and I need to communicate with it. And I model that by introducing this dotted arrow over there. And by introducing that, I also establish another happen before rule. In case that this message reaches my process for the memory and triggers some action there, in case that has happened, then it the event P1 from P has to have happened before my event on the memory process Q2. So, yeah, with these inter-process communications, I also establish a happened-before relation on there. So that's what this thing down there tells us. Okay. Good. I can make that into a formal relation by introducing my red arrow here, which should from now on mean that if I have P arrow Q, this means that the event P happened before event Q. There's certain observations that we can do in there. For example, the whole thing is a relation that's only partial. So there's pairs of events where there's just no relation holding between them. So if you look at them, there might be the situation that they're just not connected. Neither P happens before Q, or Q happens before P. The next thing is that happened before is irreflexive. So an event can never happen before itself. Well, that should go without asking, but that's one of the properties there. Then it's transitive. So if I know that that event Q happens after event P, then and I also know that R happens after Q, then I also know that R happened after P. So it's transitive. Then there's asymmetric S property. If P happens before Q, then there is Q definitely is not happening before P. Well, that's for events. I think that's pretty clear. Only one can be before the other. So if we sum that up, that makes our relation happen before into a strict partial order. Yeah. Just to wake you up a little bit, what would I need to remove to make it just a partial order? With the last thing, you mean the asymmetric S property?
Yes.
So you say that needs to be removed to make it. No? What? I didn't get you then.
I think I got the wrong idea. Yes.
Okay. So this one, yeah, well, strict means it definitely needs, well, it's just not reflexive if you have it strict. So yeah, that is something that needs to go. Well, and that might also imply that another one of those might need to go. Well, the transitive is still okay. If you have them strictly be different, then it's still okay. I think it should still work. If each of the other steps is fine for your partial order, then that's still okay. No?
I don't know.
Well, asymmetric is something that is not strictly something that has to go for partial order. So that that's just for the mathematics behind. We don't. I think we were more after the actual idea of what that gives us for. The context of events and process calculus over there. So, anyway, we can now say what we consider to be concurrent, or well, at least possibly concurrent. And it's what we mean is with concurrent is that if two distinct events P and Q are considered concurrent, then, well, there's neither a happened before relation from P to Q, nor a happened before relation from Q to P. So there, we just don't know whether, well, or there's no proof or no reason for them to happen after each other. In the example that we've seen, well, there is happened before hidden in there. For example, between P1 and R4. Well, how's that? Well, there needs to be some kind of happened before relation hidden in this diagram. And what we need to find is a way to go along the edges to reach P1 to reach R4 from P1.
So,
yeah, what can we do there? We need to reach this one, so we need to bridge the gaps between processes P and R somehow. And since there are no direct edges between, mm-hmm. So that is the first edge that you go. So that bridges the gap from P to Q.
And then from Q2 to Q4, which is obviously?
Yeah, you say obviously, but that's interestingly one of the most mistakes that people do in the exams in these kind of tests. So yeah, there's actually happened before relation between them because of the program order. Yeah. And there, then there's this one and this one. Exactly. So that is the path to go. So the only thing that's actually at least marginally complicated is that you have to interpret the program order as a generator for happened before relations. Yeah. Then the other question is turning the whole thing around. P3 and Q3 are now in focus. The question is, what is the relation between those two? Are they somehow happening before each other, or are they considered to be concurrent? Well, yeah. And why is that? There's no. So you cannot reach either one from the first one. So that would be the idea. That doesn't mean that there's no kind of path in the undirected graph. There's still there's still. This connection, if you mistreat the edges as undirected, but you have to consider the program order as directed. So yeah, that means that's not possible. Would it change something if I would ask you whether Q6 and P3 are concurrent or happened before? I might tempt you by saying, well, this happens before, so there's also this edge over here. Yeah, so it needs to be interpreted in a directed graph, and you cannot reach over here because this one is meant to be directed like this. Okay, so that's all that you need to keep in mind for this notion of concurrency and happening before. Fine with that? Okay, good. So let's talk about orderings in these systems and clocks. Well, clock quite literally is this analog instrument that you see here, but that's not what we mean here. We mean clock in a more abstract way, in the sense that a clock for us is a function that assigns a timestamp in the sense of, well, a number to each of the events that we have in our system. That is a logical clock for us. So if we can find a function such that we get that whenever we have a happened before relation between an event P and an event Q, We get from our logical clock that the timestamp for P is actually smaller than the timestamp for Q, then the function C that we have determined for our system satisfies the so-called clock condition. That means that, well, in a kind of informal way, that means that the ordering that we have found in terms of logical timestamps or labels for our events reflects all the happened before relations that we find in our system. So that's the clock conditions. So in a distributed system, the clock conditions holds if we are, well, P I and P J are events of P, so if they are on the same process line, and well, in this case, let's assume that I is smaller than J, which means that I happens before J, then the logical timestamp that we get from a clock that satisfies the clock condition must be smaller for event P I than it is for PJ. And the other condition that needs to hold is if the event P is sending a message and Q receives that message, then also the logical timestamp for P must be smaller than the timestamp for Q. So these are the two things. And if we have that, then the clock condition describes a total order that embeds the happens before relation, at least if we assign different timestamps to each of the events. But I think that's something that I so that would also need that I assign different timestamps there. So only then there's a total order, but that's not so important for us. Let's try to establish a logical clock for our system here. So what we do is we introduce this mapping by plain tables. This one, and we establish this mapping by mapping from events to evaluations of the logical clock for that event, which means the according logical timestamp that belongs to that event. So let's try that. Any idea how to design our clock? I didn't get that acoustically, and also in terms of which person. That's nice to hear. Topological sort was the proposition there, and that's actually, if you know how to perform topological searches on graphs, then you already got a lot of the tricks that you will find hidden throughout the lecture there. So that is something that you should keep in mind as a solution for this. But yeah, that's right. Perform a topological search on the graph will help us establishing such a logical clock. So what do you need to do for that? Do you remember? Who of you has not heard of topological sortings yet? Well, you don't need to be ashamed. You need to be ashamed if you can't do that in the exam afterwards. Okay. So how do I proceed? So we need to see the whole thing as a graph and consider edges. for candidates, which I give the next free number. So I start my logical clock maybe with zero, and I need to see the whole thing as a graph. And in order to do so, I might manipulate the whole thing a little bit in the sense that I remove these things because they are not really connecting to any other vertex in there. And also I need to envision our diagrams as direct graphs with edges over there. And now I can proceed with what? Sorry? Yeah, and I consider which vertices first? Yeah, let's give them different ones for establishing a total order. But yeah, that's so. In principle, what I need to to look for now is I need to look for vertices that don't have any incoming edges. R1, for example. So let's start with R1, and now I can remove this thing from the graph and start over. Yeah. Yes?
We can continue by either R2 or Q1.
Let's, for example, take the Q1, and that would be this one. This would remove this vertice as well as this outgoing edge and this outgoing edge. Yeah, you already mentioned another one that we could do in the same run.
P1,
and yeah, for example, this one, and R2. So let's do P1 with 2 and R2 with 3. So this goes away, this goes away, and you continue so forth. You see, you remove a vertice in each of these steps, and liberate other vertices from incoming edges, and just pick a random one from there, increase the counter, and place the old value from the counter in this thing in order to obtain numbering. So that was would be the way to get a clock. Yeah, what happens if I don't find a vertex without incoming edges? No, the algorithm is finished. No, but yeah, something went terribly wrong is the other correct answer to that. So these are the two outcomes for that. Either you have terminated your algorithm, of course, and the other one is, yeah, if you happen to find only vertices that still have incoming edges, there's no way to break into that thing, and yeah, in most cases there is at least one circle in the graph that you have there, and in those cases, well, there's just no topological ordering on that thing. So that's the two choices that you have, and in that case you cannot find a clock that satisfies the clock condition on this thing, which means, well, what does that actually mean for our processes? Deadlock was a proposition, and
I suppose that process cannot actually be executed correctly.
Yeah, you would have an event that somehow depends on itself as a prerequisite. I think that depends, of course, a little bit on how we use these events afterwards. So deadlock would have been a viable idea, but in this case, the way that we use them, this would mean that we that's just not a thing that can happen in a sane system. So an event that somehow has a chain of events triggered that in the end triggers itself, that's something dubious. That's In any way, if you can establish such a clock condition, then you have at least made sure that there's no such situation in there.
I have a different question. If we started up our clock, if we started giving out numbers parallelly in our clock, for example, if we number P1, Q1, and R3 with the number 1,
yeah.
Wouldn't that still be a
It wouldn't violate the clock condition anymore, but for a total order, you would have to kind of find a sequence of all the events. And
well, it's still a function that assigns a number to all events.
But yeah, it's
I just thought it would be useful since it's actually.
Yeah, it's still useful. It just isn't a total order anymore. But that doesn't. That's not problematic here. So it's just not unique anymore when each of these events actually, well, you cannot tell them apart anymore. Well, it depends a little bit on how you want to model your system. If you want to have them explicitly parallel in there, then that's that may be fine, but. Well, I think it's not as important as it is on this, as it is. It might have been come over to you, but I think what we still need is just that it doesn't violate the happen before relation. That is the most important part here. So, yeah. Good. So. Summing up what we have been given with this happened before relations is that we can read these happened before relations by looking at the events of a particular process, and we get these events from the instructions that are triggered from the code that is behind each of these processes, and we can establish happened before relations between partners in our processes when they communicate events to each other. Happened before is a strict partial order, and clock is a strict order that embeds the happened before partial order. So. With that, now we can talk about an alternative model of consistency on machines that differs a little bit from the strict consistency that we have had before, which is the sequential consistency on multiprocessor machines. And the idea is to use these process diagrams to model more relaxed memory models that allow for more concurrent computations in there than just our strict consistency enabled us to see. So what we use these process diagrams for is that we look at a certain sequence of instructions that is happening during a program. And especially, well, this depends a little bit on how the path through the program actually goes. And that is, of course, a little bit of data dependent. So we can't talk about one particular sequence of instructions that is yielded by a certain program or by a certain process. But we can talk about the instructions that are given by a certain path through the thread of a program. And what we consider for our process diagrams is the actions of each thread as an event of a process. And what we also want to look at is the memory and how it interacts with the processes. So we use processes to model memory, and it's not a mistake. It's on purpose that I write processes because, well, I might consider the memory of a system as not just a kind of a slave unit in there that always responds to actions, but it might have kind of its own environment and might also be implemented in a concurrent way. So it might be able to have events in parallel there, and we can only model that by several processes for our memory. So, yeah, we use processes for modeling memory. And in our case, what we will do is we will use one process per variable in the memory. That is not exactly what is happening on hardware. If you pay respect to the hardware guys, you will see that it's implemented not in this ideal way, but in a little bit different way. You have this concept of cache lines that are considered to be accessible at one time, and that is might be larger than just one variable. But for modeling purposes, it's okay for us here because we can still illustrate things by modeling it that way, that each variable memory is modeled by one process. So, yeah, we represent some interleavings of these processes with our model here. And with that, we can establish a model of sequential consistency. That is something that is given to you by this guy over here with his publication in 78. Sequential consistency is meant the following way. The result of any execution is the same as if the operands of all the processors were executed in some sequential order, and the operations of each individual processor appear in this sequence in the order specified by the program. Yeah, that's a lot of plain text, and this is also on a very general level, so I've broken that down to the level of sequential consistency in the context of multiprocessor programs. So that's what you'll find down here. So sequential consistency in multiprocessor programs means that given a program with n threads, so that is given, what we do to talk about sequential consistency is we fix the operation sequences for the processes that are playing together in our scenario. So for all of the n threads, we fix operation sequences P0 to Pn for process 1, P0 to Pn for process 2, and so on until we reach process n. And we fix these operation sequences keeping to the actual program order, which means that we fix these sequences according to the way the algorithm is specified with its loops, its jumps, its branches, whatever is in there, we still keep to that. And that yields us sequences. And the next thing that we need to make sure is that the executions that we fix there obey the clock condition. That means, well, the first part of the clock condition is that the sequences of events there need to happen after each other if they are specified to happen after each other by the program order. Well, that is already satisfied by this one. The other thing is that we need to introduce this happen before relation between processes if they at some point communicate with each other. So we cannot construct illegal combinations of instruction sequences that stem from two different pathways that we take in process one and process two that just don't fit together. So we need to do something which works together in order to talk about correctness here and consistency. And in case that we have chosen these instruction sequences appropriately, then all the executions that are possible within these boundaries need to yield the same result. So if I fix the way that my program takes through all my loops and all that in all these processes and connect them with each other with the happened before relations that stem from the inter-process communication, then in the end, all the things that I can vary in there, and I can vary them in certain ways, always when things are happening concurrently, I can vary a little bit in the sequences. And if that doesn't change anything in my results, then my system is sequentially correct. So that is this sequential consistency. Is that clear? Is there any question on that? It's a little bit, it's a lot if you just read it on there. I think you need to get a little bit accustomed with that, and we will do that with a few tasks that deal with sequential consistency in the next few slides. But in principle, you fix a certain way that the program unrolls. You interconnect the processes that are combined with each other and have a look at whether you can observe different outcomes or not. That's the idea. And if there is no way for different outcomes, then the system is sequentially consistent. So what can you do with such a definition? Well, what you can do is, of course, you can do extensive proofs, but that is something that's quite hard to do. What you can directly take away from that is with that you can get a certificate that a system is for sure not sequentially consistent if you keep to a certain technique. What you can do is, well, I have copied the definition of sequential consistency from the slide before over here, so that's still the same as it has been before. So with that definition, I can now perform a test whether a system is not sequentially consistent by just doing a thing like that. What I do is I pick any result of a program run that I consider to be one that is appropriate for my sequentially consistent system. This is my reference result, so to say. That is the one that is the obvious outcome of the system, how it should be. And yeah, that is the one that I pick beforehand. Then what I do is I need to be creative and come up with an execution sequence of instructions that confines that is coherent with the program order and a total ordering of all the operations. So I fix one specific run of the program with its program order and its relations between each other, and take that as my initial setup. I add the amount of processes that I want to use for modeling my system. That I pick add extra processes here as my instruction for this part, because, well, in the future we will manipulate the model which we use for the particular hardware features, so there might be extra processes involved at some point. For now, what we do is we add a process for each of the threads, and we add a process for the variables from memory. So these are the processes that we add to our system there. And with that, the original order now is the partial order, the happened before order. And now I try to tweak it in a way that I can see that there's different results than the obvious one that we thought would be possible. So what I try to do is I tinker around by just by trying to find an instruction sequence for which I can show that there's a different result computed by my system than the one that would have been obvious. Well, the one that would have been obvious is kind of a shorthand way that I have for the lecture here. In principle, you would need to show two of these things that give just different outcomes, but I will, in most cases, give you the idea of what should be computed there, and you can show me that you can find an instruction sequence that comes up with a different result. So if you can show different results there, then you have proven that in the model that you've used for your hardware with that algorithm, you can show that the algorithm behaves not sequentially consistent. So that is the idea over here. I've talked about introducing more processes to the system in order to model different features of the system. That's something that you can see, for example, here. That is one situation where I introduce or move away from the strict model that I had before, where memory was one process line, which means that all the accesses to memory had to happen one after each other. And in systems of modern in memories of modern systems, you will encounter memories that will be able to answer to several queries at the same time. So we introduce two processes for each of the variables in this here. So that is one modification that we can do in the system, where we won't be able to observe any different behavior than we had before in terms of sequential consistency. It's still the case that the access of foo to A occurs before it accesses B, so the second process will never observe a different behavior than that. It's rooted in the thing that the happened before relation between those two events here makes sure that that also the access to A has happened before the access to B is even attempted. So, yeah, there's always a happened before relation there, so we won't ever observe a different behavior. So that's quite nice. We can now assume that we can model memory in parallel. That's something that we couldn't do with strict consistency before. So sequential consistency is quite a nice, nicely behaving memory model. You can use it to kind of define correct behavior for concurrent programs in a way that suits you as a programmer quite nice. And if your algorithm turns out to be not sequentially consistent on a machine, means that the results that you get from such an algorithm will in general be not desirable anyway, because they will contain races in there. Well, yeah, it might end in several possibilities how the results might look like, so that's something you don't want to see in most of the algorithms. Yeah, it's also a realistic model for older hardware, especially one where you can get exclusive access to memory. And yeah, you can even extend sequential consistency to hardware that does even more than just offer parallel access to different memory locations. Especially, you can enhance it in a way that you can use caches and still still maintain sequential consistency in your program. How does that work? Well, it's still something over here. Yeah, we need to look deeper into how caches actually work. So that's what we're going to do next. We're going to talk about a way to increase concurrency in programming even more by considering that there's caches as an idea to optimize concurrency in a system. So what we're going to do is we're going to essentially move away from modeling our programs by just process lines for process A and B and the memory in general in there. We will move over to a model where we have process A and B, and each of them have their own cache, which means their own private copy of the memory location. So we will have, for variables A and B, we will have instances of A and B as several process lines over here. And, we will find a way to deal with this hardware via the MESI protocol, which still keeps the sequential consistency of systems intact. So that's what we're going to talk about next time, because that's still a way to go. So I would say that's all for now and today. I thank you for your attention, and we'll see us next week. I will I don't know whether I can fit an appropriate number of exercises on the first sheets. Well, maybe we'll toy around a little bit with happen before and sequential consistency. Let's first